Yes.
Okay. Let's turn to the transparency.
You speak a little bit louder, please.
Okay, let's see. Is it better like this?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Okay, so the subject of my talk today is quantum gravity, probabilities, and general boundaries. And the idea is that I want to go a bit more kind of to the conceptual side of quantum gravity and problems that that exist there. Let's turn to the next slide, which is number two. So the outline of my talk. It has three parts. So first, I want to talk about these problems, interpretational problems that we have in quantum gravity. In the context of theories like loop quantum gravity, which arise from a canonical quantization. And then I want to talk about the general boundary formulation. Giving a short general review about it, then introducing its probability interpretation. And in the third part of my talk, I will talk about applications of that. And of course, this is with a view to addressing precisely the first part of my talk, namely these interpretational problems. The examples I will discuss in the third part are firstly from quantum field theory, and then secondly about quantum gravity and gravitons. Okay, so let's turn to slide number three. The most popular approaches to quantum gravity assume that somehow standard quantum theory holds. Usually we develop a certain approach in a technical way and try to work towards getting solid kind of, let's say, mathematical results, but we don't always care very much about what is really the interpretation of the results that come out. For example, the popular approaches to quantum gravity have the following output. So it can be an F matrix, that's, for example, the case in string theory, or transition amplitude, and that's the case for loop quantum gravity. So, I'm not trying to give an exhaustive list of possible approaches and things that we could have. I just want to highlight the most popular ones here. Now, the point is that in quantum field theory, such quantities can be directly converted to observer probabilities. There are well-defined prescriptions to convert an S matrix into a cross-section that you can measure in an experiment, or a transition amplitude in a probability for observing some final state given some initial state. However, in quantum gravity, several problems appear when we try to relate such quantities to observable quantities, and observable quantities means in quantum mechanics or quantum theory, generally probabilities. So today I will focus just on the second case mentioned above, and that's transition amplitude. And the problem that appear when interpreting such quantities in the context of quantum gravity that I want to consider today are firstly the problem of time, or let's say a version of the problem of time, and secondly something that I will call the quantum cosmology problem. So let's turn to slide number four. This is about the problem of time. So we consider a transition amplitude, firstly, in a background space-time. So the picture is the space-time picture. So on the one axis, you have space, indicated by x, and on the other, time. And so if we look at a transition amplitude, in space-time looks like this. We have an initial time t1 and a final time t2, and we want to know how the system evolves between those two times. So more specifically, the question we ask in quantum mechanics is, suppose we prepare a state psi at time t1 and wait for a time delta t until t2, and then we want to know if the final state is eta or not. And the probability is this formula that's indicated there. So that's just the modulo square of the time evolution operator u applied to psi in a product with eta. So that's just the kind of most simple and standard formula for probability in quantum mechanics. So at this point, I want to just briefly recall two properties of this time evolution operator. So firstly, it has a composition property. So if you compose two time evolutions, it corresponds to the evolution of the sum of the times, and then it's unitary. And both of these properties are essential for the theory to be well-defined and to have a consistent probability interpretation that and conservation of probability. Okay, let's turn to the next slide. That's number 5. So if we want to switch to quantum gravity, then there's no background time that we can plug into this evolution operator u. I mean, at this point, what I want to do, I just want to suppose that we try to kind of apply this most standard quantum mechanical prescription to quantum gravity and see what happens. So we don't have this delta t that we can plug into this operator u. So furthermore, having these two properties that I mentioned at the end of the last slide in mind, namely composition and unitarity, then that means that this operator actually has to be the identity. So we could say if we kind of try to stick to this way of doing things, that then the transition probability from psi to eta is just an inner product. It's the modulo square of the inner product. But the problem, of course, now is that if we take this prescription, then it is unclear how the operational information of this time difference, delta t, can be encoded into the expression for this probability, because there's no u now that carries this information. Okay, so let's go to slide number 6. Okay, of course, the idea to solve this problem now would be that we encode this information somehow into the state. So what I want to consider here is we think we are in quantum gravity, but to kind of understand this issue, we suppose that we can go to a semi-classical regime where the states that we consider essentially correspond to classical three metrics. So then we have something that's called the thick sandwich conjecture sometimes, which means that, let's first look at this picture. So again, we have x and t, and now we have two space-like hypersurfaces, and we think about metrics h and h prime on these hypersurfaces. The idea of this this thick sandwich conjecture is then that if we have this initial three-metric h and a final three-metric h prime, then there's generically one four metric that interpolates between them, of course, up to equivalent of diffeomorphism that change g in the inside only. Well, of course, this conjecture doesn't really work in a strict sense, but people have hoped that one can make sense of such a conjecture. Okay, so now suppose that within this kind of semi-classical assumption that we can associate quantum states in some sense with these metrics, which I will call here psi h and psi h prime. So then the tentative transition probability would be this, the modulo square of this inner product that was on the previous slide. So now the thing is that this quantity now does contain this information about this delta t, because that's contained in the state. So if we have h and h prime, then we can infer the delta t by working out this interpolating form metric and then measuring just along a path that connects a point on the initial and a point on the final hypersurface and integrate the metric along this path to know this time difference. So that seems to be like a way out of this problem of not being able to encode this information in the transition amplitude. However, so if we take this seriously, then we have another problem. And that problem is that, so the probability, I mean, in this special context here where suppose where we can match h with h prime, then of course the probability for measuring h prime given h before should be 1. But also the probability of measuring h given that we had h before should also be 1, because that would just correspond to measuring instantaneously after the preparation. So, but that would mean we're talking about normalized states here. So that would mean that the states psi h and psi h prime are really the same up to phase. However, h and h prime are, of course, physically different states in general. So meaning here that there's no 3D diffeomorphism that relates the two.
Robert, this is can you hold? This is Abhay Ashtakar. I'm a bit confused at this stage because
yes.
I do not know which of your remarks are supposed to be precise and which are supposed to be just qualitative. So, for example, I really don't see in the semi-classical regime why the inner product between psi h prime psi h whole squared equal to 1. The logic is to use the previous transparency where you said u squared is equal to 1 and u dagger equal to 1. But u squared is not equal to 1. I mean, you said at that time u squared is equal to 1 because we don't have a notion of time. But in the semi-classical regime, you would have some notion of time. So I don't know exactly what you mean by semi-classical regime. My second point of confusion is that in the quantum cosmology context and so on, the way all the problems you have talked about have been traditionally solved is to use deparametrized theory, perhaps at least locally, use some kind of a matter field as a clock. And then again, I mean, u squared is not equal to 1. You're talking about correlation, talking about, say, if you're the matter field, scalar field is a time, then you're saying the scalar field is so-and-so, the state is so-and-so, and what is the state when the scalar field is something else? Perfectly unitary evolution, and there is no problem at all. So somehow you are not taking into account possible precise formulations, and the discussion is general and somewhat vague, so I'm confused as to whether you are saying that there is a genuine problem or just motivating what you want to do.
Okay, let me try to be more precise. So I'm not claiming that this is a problem that that has no solution or something like that. What I'm really trying to say is that let's go back one transparency. What I'm trying to say is that if we take this prescription in this kind of strict way, series, and try to absolutely stick to this kind of standard prescription, then we arrive at this conclusion. And the fact, so the you that it's one, it's really because this you does not know about the fact that we are in a semi-classical regime. So this you is supposed to be the exact you in a background independent you. So this of course, I mean, I'm trying to push here kind of the very kind of standard framework and standard formulas of quantum mechanics to the limit. I'm not saying that there's no way to avoid this and to get around this. I'm just trying to say if we kind of are in this very strict and very limited context, then this is kind of what happens. I hope that...
Thank you, Robert.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
So,
Robert?
Okay. Yes?
Yeah, this is Jonathan Engel.
Okay. Hi, John.
You make the argument that because there's no background time, that therefore you is not parameterized by anything, but really you would be parameterized by a choice of initial and final hypercircles. Would that not be the case? So it would be a parameterization, but not by a real number. So that you, given that parameterization with these initial and final hypersurfaces, you couldn't make this argument that U equals 1.
Yeah, I mean, so the argument here is really that at this point, of course the picture is a bit misleading because it really is a kind of completely classical picture. So the idea is that really this hypersurface in your full theory, you don't have any background, so you're just having a differentiable manifold. And so, I mean, in a sense, they're just, these two hypersurfaces within this manifold don't have any more information than being different, essentially, and some kind of global topological information.
I see. Yes.
And so, I don't know if that answers your question.
It does.
Okay. And so let's proceed to the next transparency. So that's number 7. So this is what I want to call the quantum cosmology problem, and it's much simpler to explain. So states are associated with space-like hypersurfaces, and these, of course, extend over the whole universe. So a priori, a state is a state of the whole universe. So, I mean, that's just nothing deep there. Of course, in quantum field theory, we can avoid talking about the whole universe by noticing that distant systems with respect to the background matrix are independent. So to establish this independence, we use causality and cluster decomposition and things like that. And that implies that we can successfully describe a local or an isolated system as if it was alone in a Minkowski universe. I mean, that's what we do all the time in quantum mechanics and quantum field theory. Of course, in quantum gravity, there's no background there that we can use to separate systems. And what's worse, we have a diffeomorphism gauge symmetry that makes any kind of localization difficult. So we need to worry about the global structure of space-time, or at least space, if we talk about these space-like hypersurfaces. And it seems hard to avoiding to have to that we have to do quantum cosmology, really. And when I say quantum cosmology, that might imply all kinds of interpretational problems as well as thinking about the no observer outside the universe and those kind of things. But again, note that I'm not saying that this is a fundamental obstacle. I'm just, of course, these things can be addressed and are addressed. I'm just saying that a priori, this is a difficulty of a formulation that's based on transition amplitudes with space-like hypersurfaces. Or, for example, of course, that would also apply to an S-matrix formulation in string theory and things like that. Okay, so now I want to come to the second part of my talk, to the general boundary formulation. So, and later I will go back to connect to these problems. to say how what I'm going to say now kind of addresses these problems or avoids them. So let's go to the slide number 8. Okay, so here is shown the basic idea of the general boundary formulation. We have this, again, we talk about transition amplitude. So in standard quantum mechanics, transition amplitude is between states at two different times with evolution between. Then in perfect space-time, we have a more general space like hypersurfaces or Cauchy surfaces, and time evolution between them, between states on these hypersurfaces. Now, if we could go one step further, that's the idea, and that's to say, why don't we admit more general regions of space-time and their boundaries in the same sense? So in the same sense as the space-time region between two hypersurfaces is a region that has boundaries which are these two hypersurfaces. So that means now we will have these regions and their boundaries, where the boundaries carry the state space, and the inside kind of corresponds to an amplitude that we can evaluate with those states. Okay, let's
Robert, Robert, I have a question about the transparency.
Okay.
So if I was just looking at classical physics, not quantum physics, so it could be relativity, it could be some other fields propagating on a curved space-time. Then, if I look at the left-hand picture, which has to do with what we call standard picture, again, I got a Cauchy surface. I can give initial data and evolve, or I could try to do what you call the thick sandwich, in which I specify some initial data and the final data, and subject to many, many conditions, there will exist a solution in between. Now, if I went to the curved space-time picture, the same thing is true, provided there are no time-like boundaries, provided these boundaries are all space-like. Now, the right-hand corner that you have out there, where the boundary is kind of mixed space-like time-like, in the classical theory, at least as far as I know, there is no result whatsoever which would say that you can specify a state, any kind of initial data, on the boundary and then evolve inside and get a solution. Typically, there will be no solution at all, or there may be more than one solution. So if this program is going from the first two pictures to the last picture, does not at all work in the classical theory, why is there any reason to take it seriously, to take it over to quantum theory? What is it specifically about quantum mechanics or quantum physics that might allow me to do something when I know it cannot be done in classical theory?
Okay, so the problem that you are talking about is the one of initial data, in a sense, and matching data on a boundary with classical solution. First of all, I should say that, as you said, this is a purely classical problem, but the moment I would have to worry about is if I think about quantization prescriptions, okay? Because here I really want to talk about purely the quantum theory, but in the moment when I want to think about quantization prescriptions, this is a problem I would have to worry about. It's not the case that if I have a specific prescription of boundary data, then I can generally not find a solution in the inside. This is only true if you assume the boundary data to have a specific form. So, I mean, usually you would think in terms of initial value problems in splitting a phase space in configurations and momenta, say, and then you would specify the configuration. Of course, in the general case, it's like the picture on the right-hand side, this is more complicated, and the data will on the boundary will not generally be simple configuration data. It will be a bit more complicated, the way the data are prescribed. But that doesn't mean that there can be established a correspondence between such data and a classical solution. If I have time, I will come back to this problem in an example where this is solved in the case of the Klein-Gordon series, or the Klein-Gordon equation, if you want. But I'm sorry that I have to defer this to later if there's time.
Robert, this is Alejandro from Marseille. Just a little comment regarding Abai's question. Couldn't we say that, I mean, for those configurations which don't have any, or in a semi-classical sense, do not correspond to any solution, or those configurations for those for which there is no classical solution, that the quantum theory will predict probability zero or something like that, so that there is, in principle, no contradiction. I mean, in the quantum theory, we have much more states, not all of them correspond to semi-classical quantity.
Robert, could
in a sense, yeah, but you can, I mean, this can actually be done even on the classical side to some extent. I mean, you are right in saying that this could take, for example, the form of excluding some states in some sense. I guess to make this slightly more clear, I will mention one example more explicitly, which is the one of the Klein-Gordon theory. So, for example, if you take, this is still a context where the region is infinite, but it has time-like boundaries. So, for example, if you take two parallel time-like hyperplanes in Minkowski space, then you can find a relatively simple prescription to prescribe boundary data on them that corresponds precisely to one classical solution interpolating between them. And, I cannot really elaborate on this here, but at the end of the talk, I will point you to references where this is done explicitly. Okay. So I think it's best to proceed now. And come back to this issue at the end. Okay, so let's go to slide number 9. As I said, the basic structures, so we have basic structures on the geometric side and on the algebraic side. So on the geometric side, these are regions of space-time. On the one hand, and hypersurfaces on the other hand. And in particular, these hypersurfaces arise as boundaries of these regions. And they are also oriented, but this will not play an important role in this talk. The algebraic structures are that we associate to each hypersurface a Hilbert space of states, and that we associate to each region with a boundary a linear amplitude map that goes from the state space on the boundary to the complex numbers. And then there are a list of rules that these structures have to satisfy. And for those people who know about that, it's very similar to the algebraic rules of topological quantum field theory. But that doesn't have anything to do with the theory being topological or not here. So just to mention two of these rules, if we have a hypersurface and change its orientation to the opposite, then the associated state space is dualized. Another rule is that if we have a disjoint union of hypersurfaces, so a hypersurface that is such a disjoint union, then the associated Hilbert space is the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces for the individual hypersurface. Okay, questions about this here? Okay, that's not okay. So let's go to transparency number 10. So given these structures, how do we get back the standard structures of quantum mechanics? So we go to the geometry of the standard transition amplitude. That's the picture similar to what we've seen before. So this region is now the time interval from time t1 to time t2 times all of space. Its boundary has two components, namely the initial and the final hypersurface. And of course, it's a disjoint union of those. So using the rules that I mentioned on the previous slide means that the state space for the total boundary is the tensor product of the state spaces for the initial and the final boundary. And then there's also an issue about the orientation, that the orientation of the hypersurface is induced by the orientation of the interior, which means in this example that in this boundary, the sigma 1 and sigma 2 as boundaries of M have opposite orientation. So if we want to make them have the same orientation, it means using the other rule of the previous transparency that we dualize one of them. So we see that the state space is H sigma 1 tensor H sigma 2 star. Now, using time translation symmetry, we identify all state spaces at all times. So all that are associated with the fixed time hypersurface in the same orientation. And then this is just this state space of standard quantum mechanics. So which means that we can write the amplitude as a map H tensor H star to C, so the complex numbers. So and then the relation of this to the standard time evolution operator U is shown at the bottom. Okay, so rho of psi tensor eta is the transition amplitude from psi to eta in the standard picture. Okay. So let's go to the next slide. Okay, so far, what I've talked about is, in a sense, is a technical extension of quantum theory or quantum mechanics, in that we just introduced, in a sense, new mathematical quantities and new rules. But the quantities that have a direct physical interpretation, those we haven't really touched, because so far, probabilities are really only associated with the modulo squares of normal transition amplitudes. So obviously, this is not enough to address the conceptual problems that I talked about in the first part of the talk. So what we want, so obviously, to address the quantum cosmology problem, we want to use these local regions of space-time, but that we can now associate amplitudes with. But so what we need is a direct physical interpretation of these amplitudes for these local regions. Obviously, in general, the boundary state space of such a region does not split into a tensor product of initial and final state space. So that means we cannot really use the standard probability formula of quantum mechanics, but we need something new. And it turns out that this new thing will also allow us to avoid the problem of time. Okay, so now I will talk about this generalized probability interpretation. So let's go to slide number 12. Consider the context of the general spacetime region M with boundary sigma. So the picture in the corner on the right. Now about probabilities. So remember that, of course, probabilities in quantum theory are generally conditional probabilities, which means they depend on two pieces of information, one of them being the preparation and one the observation. And here we have exactly the same thing. So we have two pieces of information. And those two pieces are now subspaces of our boundary state space. So there's one subspace S, which represents the preparation or the knowledge about the experiment in some sense, and another subspace A that represents the observation or the question that we're asking of the experiment. Okay, now the probability that the system is described by A, given that it is described by S, is the following. So P, A, S is this kind of notation supposed to indicate that we look for A conditional on S, is this quotient formula. So let me explain this formula. So first of all, so since we have subspaces, which in fact they should be closed subspaces, we have orthogonal projection operators onto these subspaces, and these I call here PS and PA. Now that means in particular that we can compose them with the amplitude map. So we can first apply a projector and then the amplitude map, or one projector, another projector, and then the amplitude map. So, and what we get is, of course, again, a map from the state space H sigma to the complex numbers. Now, observe that if we have a bounded linear map from Hilbert space to the complex numbers, then there's a vector in the Hilbert space, so that this map is the same thing as taking the inner product with this vector. And then, so we can use that to define the norm of such a map just to be the norm of this vector. And this is the sense in which the norm symbol is used in the formula. So the norm of the map in the numerator and the denominator are defined precisely in this way. Okay, so at this point, are there questions about this, the formula and, on the technical side?
Yes, the very bottom of your transparency, basically, when you say bounded map, it has to do with some kind of continuity, right?
Yes.
If I have a continuous map from state psi into complex numbers, then there exists some element C in the Hilbert space. So what is the analog of this continuity requirement in the formula that you have? What is it that is telling you that such a requirement is satisfied so that you can take the square? Robert, anytime people are asking questions, please switch off your speaker to avoid the echo. Okay, did you get my question so far?
Yes, I got it.
Okay.
The fact that this map should be bounded is a condition here on the subspace S, I should have mentioned. So in a sense, you cannot choose S to be very small. You have to choose it sufficiently. You cannot choose S to be too big, which would correspond to knowing very little or almost nothing about the experiment. So you have to choose it sufficiently big. Sufficiently small. Yes. So meaning sufficiently specific for this to work. On the next transparency, I will make a remark about this. So in the standard transition amplitude, this is always satisfied. But I will come to that in the next slide. More questions?
Robert?
Yes?
I have a question on this formula. Can you explain a bit more? Rho, you define it as being, rho sigma was a vector, but rho m is a map, ps is a map. And then why do you take the norm square? Why don't you take the trace? So rho m, ps, and pa are operators on your Hilbert space, right?
Yes. No, rho is not an operator. Rho is a map to the complex numbers.
So rho is a dual vector.
Yes, exactly. Well, except that, let me mention one technical point here, and that is that rho itself is generically not a bounded map. So this is why I cannot, otherwise I could use the last two lines of the slide to express the row itself as a vector, and then the formula could be phrased differently, directly in terms of norms or vectors. But the a technical point here is that this row is generically not bounded. But the row composed with DS is bounded.
Okay, I think my question is even simpler. I'm not sure the different nature of...
Okay.
So row is a vector, PS is an operator, so I'm not sure what you mean by the composition of a vector with an operator.
No, row is not a vector.
Okay, that's what. So row is a map.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
It's so why this formula will become more clear on the next transparency, I hope.
So row...
If you allow me to...
So the composition of rho with projector and with P is an operator. So what is...
No, it's a map.
It's a map.
Yes.
From H to
Robert,
H.
is it not true that rho maps compares PS and PA to a complex number?
Sorry, I didn't get your comment.
Just this question that Laura was asking, which is, I think, a confusing notation. So rho sub m assigns to the pair of projectors, PS and PA, a complex number. Is this correct?
No, it assigns to a state a complex number.
Okay,
let me try to explain it again. So
Yeah, it would be nice if you could explain what is the source of each object and target of each object.
Uh-huh.
How you
let's start with the denominator. So PS is a map from H to H. So I take this map and compose it with rho. Rho is a map from H to C. That means now I get a map from H to C. Okay?
Okay.
In the numerator, it's the same. PA is a map from H to H. Then I apply PS, which again is a map from H to H. Then I apply rho M, which is a map from H to C. So in total, again, I get a map from H to C. Okay, so in the numerator and in the denominator, I have maps from H to C. And for these maps, I take this modulus square, which I define as specified in the last two lines of the transparency. So I hope it's more or less clear now. So let's proceed to the next slide. So that's number 13. So now we want to see how this formula gives us back the usual formula for a standard transition amplitude. So again, on the left corner in the top there's this the geometry for the standard transition amplitude, and then we remember from a previous slide that the state space on this boundary decomposes into a tensor product of the state spaces of H with H star, where we can think of H as the standard state space of quantum mechanics. And then we have this formula that says how rho is related to the standard transition amplitude. Okay, so now what we want to do, so we want to compute the probability of measuring eta at T2, given that we prepared psi at T1. And this is now encoded in the following way. So the subspace S is the subspace that consists of all vectors that can be written as psi tensor something. And the subspace A consists of all the vectors that can be written as something tensor eta. Okay? Now, if we plug this into the formula of the previous slide, I don't show all the details here, but it turns out that then the denominator of this formula is equal to 1, and the numerator of this formula is precisely rho m of psi tensor eta modulus square, and we already have seen in the top of the slide or in a previous transparency that this rho m of psi tensor eta is the usual transition amplitude. So we get the modulus square of the usual transition amplitude, as we should. Okay, so this just, so are there questions about this?
I have a question. So in this case of DM where there's two slides, there's a canonical Hilbert structure on H of sigma. But my question is about, so how do you choose, so you have this space of boundary data. What Hilbert structure do you choose there? How do you choose it? What is the scalar product on this Hilbert? I mean, to define a Hilbert space, you need a vector space and Hermitian form. So how do you define the Hermitian form?
Well, so your question is really about the quantization. I mean, that's not something that I want to talk about today. What I'm really talking about is the formalism itself. So suppose you have these structures, and these structures satisfy certain axioms. So it's like throwing at you an abstract quantum mechanical system without telling you that there was some classical system or something that I used to construct the Hilbert space in a specific way with a specific inner product. So is that okay with you? That's something that I just don't want to talk about.
Let me try to understand. I mean, if you take the configuration where there are two slides, right?
Sorry?
If you take the configuration where there is two slides, then
yes.
H of DM has a canonical Hilbert structure, which is a trace, because this space is isomorphic to H tensor H dagger. So you're saying in general, you don't know if there exists a Hilbert structure on H sigma, or you don't know how to construct it from the dynamics, or you don't know, or from the theory.
The Hilbert space structure in general is an ingredient of the theory that is specified by the theory. But in this case, let me go to, so in this case, this rule that tells me that if the boundary has disconnected components, that the state space is the tensor product of the two. This is the tensor product of Hilbert spaces, which means that there's a condition that relates the inner product on HDM with the inner product on H and H star. Namely, it's just the product inner product. Okay, so the inner product naturally induced by the on the tensor product of two Hilbert spaces.
Okay, but you would
agree, I don't know if that answers your question.
But you would agree that if you choose you're saying in general there exists, or you suppose there exists some Hilbert structure on H sigma, your boundary, but different choice of Hilbert structure here leads to completely different choice of physical and probability interpretation a priori.
There's only one choice that is allowed. I mean, the axioms say, if you want, that you suppose that you have one Hilbert space structure for each hypersurface, and then you have compatibility conditions between them that ensure that everything is consistent. And unfortunately, I really don't have time to talk about these things today. I mean, there's a whole list of axioms that has to be satisfied.
Is there at least one solution? Does it always exist? That's the question. If you don't have a constructive version of it.
Oh, I mean, this is an axiomatic framework, if you want. So your question is the same as if I tell you about what is quantum mechanics, and you ask me, yeah, but what is the Hilbert space actually? I mean, this is the question that I'm not addressing at this point. This you will come to that question if you think about. Let's say you have a classical system, you want to quantize it, then how do I choose my Hilbert spaces and so on? But this is really not what I want to talk about today.
Yeah, okay, but usually you can say, well, I have a measure on the configuration space, and I take square integrable function on configuration space.
You could do things like that here too.
So here,
but this is not my subject today. I mean, this is...
Okay.
When I say quantum mechanics, I mean quantum mechanics abstractly, which is already at the stage where you have the Hilbert space. It's not at the stage where you construct them. That would be building a model or something. So this is not the aspect I want to talk about today. I'm sorry, but there's just not enough time for all this. Okay, so let's go to transparency number 14. Okay, so I guess I will be very, very short here and leave that for your later contemplation. So one important thing here about consistency and so on and interpretation of this is that there is a notion of probability conservation as we have it in quantum mechanics, in standard quantum mechanics, but it's generalized. So, or to put it differently, probability conservation in time, as we know it in quantum mechanics, is generalized to probability conservation in space-time. And so this is illustrated here with an example where there's a region M that, in a sense, deforms by region N, if you want. And then if you choose subspaces of your state space, let's say the state space associated with the outer boundary, sigma, and compute the associated probability, and now you evolve in force, of course, these subspaces to the other boundary, the inner one, the boundary of M, sigma prime, and again compute the probability that probability, then you will get the same result. And this, to see what evolution here means, is the point is that the amplitude map for this deformation N can be induces a unitary map between the state spaces for sigma and sigma prime. And if you specialize this picture to the standard picture, then you recover the standard probability conservation of standard transition amplitude. I'm sure there are questions about this here, but I really just want to flash this thing and not go deeply into that because I don't have time for that. Sorry. Let's leave it at that here and turn to slide number 15. Okay, so now we turn to the third part of the talk, and that means in a sense we're getting to examples, and in another sense we're getting to understanding how is this related or addressing these interpretational problems that I was mentioning in the first part of my talk. So first of all, let me talk about a context that's not at all quantum gravity, but that's quantum field theory. So let's consider a geometry that has the following shape, as shown here. So let me first say the context now is the following: we're in Minkowski space. And we consider Klein-Gordon theory, the Klein-Gordon quantum field theory, so three scalar fields. And we consider the following geometry that is a kind of hypercylinder. So what is that? You take the three balls in space and extend it over all of time. So that's this space-time region that I call the hypercylinder here. And its boundary is obviously the two sphere in space, also extended over all of time. And so the kind of unusual aspect of this picture with respect to standard quantum theory is that the boundary of this region is now connected. So there's no way I have an initial and a final boundary and can talk about transition from the initial to the final boundary. So in this sense, we're really beyond the standard formalism here. So this is why I bring up the example. And I should say this example is rigorously worked out, so this is not some imagination or something, and you can find that in the references that I mentioned at the end. So it turns out that the state space on this boundary is a kind of Fock space, as you could have guessed, because it's a free theory. And particles can be characterized by energy, momentum, quantum numbers, so that's very similar to what you have in the usual case where you take a space-like hypersurface or space-like plane, hyperplane. What is different is that now these energy, momentum, quantum numbers also determine if a particle is ingoing or outgoing. So in or out means now with respect to the space-time region we consider. So if we have a standard transition amplitude, then of course everything on the initial hypersurface is ingoing and everything on the final hypersurface is outgoing. This is not so here. Here, each particle individually within one state on this state space can be ingoing or outgoing. So let me just to come back to an earlier point and to advise question. So in this context, this problem of the matching of the boundary data in the classical theory and so on is really worked out and works out. So you can find that in the references that I'll mention at the end of the talk. And of course the boundary here is time-like, so this is really not the usual initial value problem. But our main interest in this here is not because of the time-likeness of the boundary, but because it's connected and does not split into initial and final parts. So let's say we want to describe a 1-1 scattering process, meaning we have one particle going in and one coming out. So the ingoing one has some quantum numbers Pn, and the outgoing one has some quantum numbers Q out. Are there questions about this slide, brief questions?
Well, in the usual quantum theory, if I was just looking at space-like surfaces, then I know that the inner product is very non-local for Klein-Gödel theory, because we have to do positive and negative frequency decomposition. So what are we doing on the time-like boundary?
The easiest way to think about this is in terms of the energy, momentum, quantum numbers to understand what the particles are. In the usual case, it's convenient to specify particles by 3 momentum. In this case, it's convenient to characterize them in terms of a spherical harmonic mode in space and a total and the energy. And so a priori what you find is that the energy can be positive or negative, but this corresponds here to the particles being incoming or outgoing, and it's related to in a sense to the sign of the momentum of the total momentum going in or out. But the size of the state space, the choices you have are not more than on a standard space-like hypersurface. So you're not, as you might think, doubling your particle spectrum or something like that. But to see the details of that, I really would urge you to look at the papers where this is done in detail. So I don't have time to do this in detail here. Does that answer your question to some extent, at least?
Yeah, I mean, I should look at the papers in detail, then I will. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
I have a quick question. This is Kirill from PI. In this case, when you have excitations which are plane waves, you can clearly, they register on any cylinder type boundary. But imagine you have theory with local excitations, point particles. Then by enlarging the region in which you work, you get bigger system with more degrees of freedom. So you should not expect that the Hilbert spaces are the same, and therefore when you enlarge the region, the map between them shouldn't be unitary. Can you comment on this?
The unitarity really has to do with the probability conservation.
You don't want to have probability conservation. If you enlarge the system, you typically have bigger system, more more stuff in it, and so bigger Hilbert space. So you don't want
no, in enlarging here doesn't really mean putting more stuff into it. It just means changing the range in which you propagate, in a sense. So it's the same.
My way to say it clear, it doesn't mean that. But in a system with localized excitation, for example, consider a system with point particles, then you cannot register point particle which is outside of your region. It will not register on the boundary of your region. So enlarging, there are systems in which enlarging the region doesn't change number of degrees of freedom. But there are other systems in which it means exactly that. So
to answer that question to some extent, if you do non-relativistic quantum mechanics with point particles, you see indeed things like that happening. That, and in fact, that leads to a difference to standard non-relativistic quantum mechanics, and you will find, in fact, that you need to change your state spaces in the sense that you need to admit arbitrary particle numbers. So in a sense, when you do that with non-relativistic quantum mechanics, you find that similarly, as in quantum field theory, you, in a sense, you don't have particle number conservation. And I, at the end of the talk, I can point you to one paper where there's something about that. But this problem does not appear in this context here.
Yeah, please go on.
Okay. So let's go to slide number 16. Now what we want to do, so we want to consider the scattering problem of this one particle going to one particle. So to obtain a probability, we need to specify these two pieces of information that I mentioned before, namely, on the one hand, the knowledge about the experiment, and on the other hand, the question. So in this case, the knowledge we want to put in is that exactly one particle goes in with the quantum numbers Cn, but we don't know what comes out. And so S will be the subspace of H sigma of states that are described by this property. So I didn't write it explicitly there because, I wanted to avoid to make things too complicated here, but you can, it's straightforward if you work in this formalism to do that. So, and you can look at it in the papers for the details. Now the question that we want to ask is if one particle comes out with the quantum numbers Q out, and at this point we don't necessarily care about what goes in. So A is the subspace of states that are described by this property, meaning that there is one out particle Q out and arbitrarily many in particles. So this describes the subspace. So then it turns out in this specific case that we find that the resulting probability is the modulo square of the amplitude of a specific state, which, as you can expect, is the state with one in particle P in and one out particle Q out. But it's important to remember that a priori the probability formula is a quotient, and in this special case, similarly as on the previous transparency where we considered standard transition amplitudes, the denominator of this formula turns out to be 1. I don't have time to go into detail about that. So finally, of course, since we are in a free theory here, this probability is actually a kind of delta function, of course. So this thing is completely worked out, and at the end I will tell you in which paper you can find that, the details of that. So much about the quantum field theory. Now let's move to quantum gravity, and of course now things become speculative. So let's go to slide number 17. So to connect a bit with the previous talks, especially by Carlo and by Simone, I want to take the example of graviton scattering in quantum gravity. Okay, so, and I want to use that here specifically to address this problem of time that I mentioned in the first part of the talk. But so let's first look about how to formulate the thing here. So we want to consider a region that has topologically a ball in space-time, say. And the boundary is a free sphere then. And we suppose that we're really in a background-independent context, meaning that there's no background metric. I mean, there's topology and maybe differentiable structure, but there's no metric. Okay, so now we have the state space. I mean, supposing we have this theory, then we have the state space, a state space H sigma associated with its boundary, with the boundary of this region. And now we're supposing, I mean, that this state space has a factor, let's call it H lim, that in some approximately sense describes graviton on a Minkowski space-time. Okay? Of course, I mean, this is all very approximate and kind of speculative, and I'm just using that to, as a kind of in-principle demonstration of here. So again, we want to describe, let's say, a 1-1 scattering process. So within this kind of graviton Minkowski sector of our Hilbert space, we want to consider an in particle and being an in graviton now, and consider the probability of given preparing this in particle that we find an out particle with the quantum number Q out. So, and of course, this is very much, I mean, supposing that we are really having this kind of linearized, kind of approximately free sector of the theory, we are very much in a situation analogous to the previous example. And indeed, the subspaces S and A to describe this probability will be set up very much in analogy to the previous example. The difference, of course, now is that they are now both subspaces not only of the total Hilbert space, but in particular of this subsector subspace H lin. And then supposing that these are really kind of behaving like free gravitons or something, then the dynamics, so supposing that that would be the dynamics, then the result, the probability formula would work out essentially like in the previous example, and we would get the amplitude of a state which is a two graviton state with the given quantum numbers, and the modulus square of that would be the probability for the scattering process. Okay, let's go to the next slide, number 18. Okay, so now, in saying these things and doing that, it seems that that nowhere I've talked about the problem of time or encountered the problem of time. And now to understand how this procedure really avoids the problem of time, this is what I want to discuss in this transparency. So first of all, notice that as in the case of this hypercylinder in Minkowski space, this result cannot be obtained as a standard transition amplitude, meaning that we don't have an initial and a final state space and write this as an amplitude between those two. And so and this is really one of the key points of this talk. The key to avoiding the problem of time is that the subspace S fixes this time delta t that I mentioned in the beginning when I talked about the problem of time. And so now this is very crucial. So it might seem that the key is that we have changed our boundaries and have a different type of space-time region and so on, and that we can encode this time difference on the boundary of this region. But this is not really the essential point. The essential point is really this probability formula that allows us to do it through the choice of the subspaces S and A. So the third point on this transparency, so in particular, we could apply the same reasoning to a region with space-like boundaries, okay, which would correspond to the same topologically or geometrically, let's say, to the same picture I showed in the beginning when I was talking about the problem of time. The crucial point, and this is absolutely crucial, is that now the subspaces S and A would not factorize as subspaces of the way the total Hilbert space decomposes into tensor product of initial and final Hilbert space. Okay? And neither, of course, would this decomposition into the linear sector and the rest. But the more important part is that S and A do not factorize with respect to the tensor product of initial and final Hilbert space. Okay, and that means that S and A contain information that is distributed between the initial and final Hilbert space. And so the problem, to put it in a different way, the problem of time would appear again here if I would restrict myself to only allowing S to be of the form psi tensor H final and A to be of the form H initial tensor eta. Okay? And then, so what I said already, the fact that we consider a region of space-time with connected boundary is useful, for example, to avoid this sandwich conjecture, but it's not essential to avoid the problem of time. So perhaps here I should solicit some questions, because this is really one of the crucial points in this talk.
So this is Abhay again. So in this discussion, the Hilbert space H rest seems to me was just going for a ride. Didn't do really anything, so I could just look at the Hilbert space H linearized. Okay? Now supposing, as you say, if I had done linearized gravity in Minkowski space-time, and if I had an initial hypersurface and a final hypersurface, the total Hilbert space would be a tensor product, the point that you were just emphasizing, H tensor product with H star.
Yes.
Now supposing, actually I consider a initial space-like surface and final space-like surface, but they don't go out all the way to infinity. Suppose they go out to a very, very, very large radius, and there's another boundary, which is just a little bit of a cylinder. I'm like cylinder, which joins the surface to the final surface. So in the linearized theory, already in this case, would the decomposition, would the writing of H as tensor product H star fail because I have added the time-like boundary? Or is it the case that I still have such a decomposition for the linear writing?
So I didn't catch your question completely acoustically, but anyway, let me try to to answer what I think was the main point of your question. So if I understood correctly, what you're saying is, so if anyway we're looking at this linearized sector, then in this linearized sector, then I wouldn't really have this problem of time, because then there, of course, I can measure times with respect to my background and so on. So the point here is really that I'm talking, the H sigma is really of the full theory, and I want to look at transition amplitudes or amplitudes in the full theory, and I don't allow my theory first to cook it down to a kind of linearized theory and then set it up kind of anew with initial and final hypersurfaces. Or putting it a different way, when you go to the linearized sector, the information about the time difference, then you already extracted the information about the time difference, if you want, between initial and final hypersurface. But that, in the full theory, you cannot do that. So
that is not my question. Let me just clarify the question. If you have an initial and final hypersurface, one would associate a Hilbert space with the initial surface, the final surface, and the total Hilbert space would be h tensor power root h star. Now, supposing I had a hypersurface and a final, but they don't go out all the way to infinity. They are actually just joined at a large time-like cylinder. Already in this case, would I lose a decomposition of the space into H star?
There were some problems in the line, but your point was that if I let the hypersurfaces go to infinity, is that right?
I think we should just go on because the telephone bridge will not be available after about 10 minutes. You finish.
Okay, so let's go to slide number 19, and now I want to relate what I was talking about to the recent talks of Carlo and of Simone, and to the recent works about computing and extracting a graviton propagator from a background independent loop quantum gravity spin form setting. So first, I mean to get myself closer to the language that's used in those words. So we are talking about this linearized sector now. So suppose that we have creation and annihilation operators in this sector. We are having a kind of Minkowski vacuum state, then we could write the amplitude of this, then we could write this two graviton state with P in and P out as applying the creation operators for those gravitons on this kind of Minkowski vacuum state. And then I'm just rewriting this probability using that notation. And then in the second step, you could replace the creation operators by kind of field operators, noticing that that the annihilation part of the field operators will just not play any role here. So the point is that the way this expression looks like on the right-hand side is now very similar to the expressions that were computed in these works. So what I'm getting at here is that in this sense, these recent computations of the graviton propagator could be interpreted precisely in the sense that I was talking about as yielding one graviton scattering probability via this probability formula. However, a word of caution here, and it's important to remember what I mentioned before, is that this amplitude modulus square of this amplitude for a state in general is not a probability. Remember that this probability formula has a numerator and a denominator, and it's a very special situation that makes this denominator equal to 1. Just as a word of caution, you cannot just take a state and apply the amplitude to it, take the modulus squared, and that's the probability. So in the above situation, that's a kind of very special situation. And also, this fact, in a sense, should only hold approximately, because remember that This linear sector we're talking about is, in some sense, should just be some kind of approximation, and will not strictly be a sector of free or weakly interacting gravitons, but will probably be only definable by introducing some kind of cutoff on the energy of gravitons or things like that, and will in this sense only be approximate. And another remark in this respect here is that this kind of approximate sense in which this should be a Fock space with gravitons is, I mean, one could speculate that this is precisely related to the ambiguities that we find when we try to renormalize perturbative quantum gravity. Let me solicit questions at this point about this slide. Or any questions about this?
Robert, the phone bridge is only available for 5 minutes more, so why don't you sort of wrap it up?
Okay, yeah. Okay, anyway, I'm close to the end of my talk here. So let's go to the slide number 20, conclusions. So I just want to point out three things here. First one, the first two related to the interpretation of problems that I started the talk with. So the first one is that the probability formula enables us to encode the information about this time difference that I mentioned when talking about the problem of time, and thus allows us to avoid the problem of time in the full background independent context. So that's the first main point. The second one, which was already more or less implicit, is that now having state spaces, amplitudes, and probability for local regions in space-time means that we can describe their physics independent of the physics outside, and thus avoid the quantum cosmology problem. So in particular, we can describe local physics without worrying about the global structure of space-time and things like that. And we don't need for that to invoke causality or things like cluster decomposition or things like that. The third point I want to make here is that this generalized probability formula, as I just said in the previous slide, could be used to interpret these recent computations of the graviton propagator in terms of scattering probabilities. So let's go to the next slide. And this is just a brief outlook. So I want to stress that this general boundary formulation is still very much work in progress. And one route for developing it is by application to known physics, in particular quantum field theory. Some of this has been done already. See the references. And some points that I want to just point out here is that one thing is to apply this to a more general quantum field theory. Another is to derive the S matrix of quantum field theory in this context. So in fact, with Daniele Colossi, we are already close to that. Thirdly, develop suitable quantization prescriptions. So this goes back to Abai's question that on the first slide of the general boundary formulation. Then applications to loop quantum gravity and spin foams. So for spin foams, it's in a sense rather natural to cast them in this general boundary form because one anyway usually considers finite spin foams, and what one would have to care about is just to formalize their boundaries and the boundary data in boundary Hilbert spaces properly. Now, for loop quantum gravity, the situation is different because this is based on space-like hypersurfaces, so one would have to generalize that. And, of course, this is there's a big question mark about this because that would really mean generalizing canonical quantization. Some other points are this whole framework, of course, can as well be applied to other quantum gravity approaches, for example, it could be applied to string theory. Other aspects here worth mentioning, perhaps, are that, okay, firstly, one should develop an understanding of these non-standard probabilities, meaning probabilities that cannot be obtained with the standard formula, And this here, especially in non-perturbative context. And another aspect that goes a bit more to the kind of interpretational side of things of quantum mechanics would be understanding the implications of this for the interpretational issues of quantum mechanics like collapse of the wave function. So finally, let me just mention that the following two slides contain some references about the general boundary formulation that you can look at. So I will finish with that, and thank you for listening.
I think we have no more time for questions, so let's thank Robert.